The final argument for this term is in the matter of the discipline of Benjamin J. Eicher, attorney at law. Mr. Robert Freeburg, an attorney from Beresford, is counsel for the disciplinary board of the state of South Dakota. Mr. Ronald Banks, an attorney from Rapid City, is counsel for Mr. Eicher, and Mr. Eicher is present in the courtroom. Should be noted for the record that Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, retired former Chief Justice of this court, to sit instead of Justice Konenkamp. Mr. Freeburg, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Banks, Mr. Eicher. This case is somewhat unusual in the sense that it deals with a topic not frequently seen in matters of attorney discipline. Nonetheless, it is here because the board's concern that the respondent's conduct was violative of the rules, that as the matter progressed, there was no acknowledgement or recognition on his part that he was engaging in conduct violative of the rules, and that conduct was egregious enough to require some kind of public discipline. As the court knows, the disciplinary board takes its obligations to judge these matters fairly and carefully, very seriously. Early on in this proceeding, the respondent attacked the members of the board, accused them of some kind of personal vendetta or animosity toward him, raised this essentially after the board hearing, but prior to the time that the referee, retired Judge Martin, heard the matter. This based principally upon the notion that there were some conversation and correspondence between him and one of the board members, Patricia Myers, which he took as indicating some kind of bias toward him. There was also the fact that the board had, on its own initiative, made inquiry of the respondent concerning his relationship with a particular lawyer, which inquiry stemmed from another case that the board had under consideration, and in the course of which it had seen some correspondence and so on that raised this same question about this hostile, improper conduct from the respondent toward other persons involved with him in the course of carrying out his professional obligations. When we got to the referee's hearing, that matter was discussed preliminarily at least, and Judge Martin assured everyone that he would consider this matter de novo, that the board's recommendation would have no binding effect upon him, and that he would make his own determination based on the record and the testimony that he heard in the course of that proceeding. So it would be the board's position that whether there's any suspicion of any kind of personal bias, which the board vehemently denies, Judge Martin certainly cured that by making his own independent determination. Interestingly, if you recall the arguments and the objections that respondent made to the referee's recommendations, the only finding which he concedes that Judge Martin made de novo was the one which disagreed with the board. In the course of this proceeding, the responses from the respondent have been to generally admit all of the facts upon which the board's recommendation was based. In other words, He admits that the transcript of the proceedings in the Martin criminal case are correct, that it took, you know, some time for him to finally fess up to the judge what he knew about a missing videotape. He concedes that he disparaged, well, he wouldn't call it disparagement, but that he said things about Mr. Cook, Mr. Cook's client, that were inflammatory. He concedes that he tried to bargain away the complaint Mr. Cook filed with the disciplinary board. He concedes that his conduct caused a conflict between Mr. Cook and Mr. Cook's client. His position is that what he did is okay in the name of vigorous advocacy and seems to miss the point that the board's findings and recommendation are not opposed to or critical of vigorous advocacy. The board's finding and recommendation, almost all of which were supported by Judge Martin, are that this goes too far, that it is detrimental to the administration of justice, that it interferes with the very orderly manner in which lawyers need to carry out their work. In his objections, for example, to the referee's finding, he claims some kind of immunity with respect to these disciplinary proceedings. In other words, he seems to take the position that this is some kind of a civil action against him arising out of his conduct, which, because of the rules about immunity and disciplinary matters, relieves him from any obligation. He seems to fail to grasp the notion that what this proceeding is about is the regulation of the profession and exercise of the court's inherent power to do that. And that's what the board is concerned about. That's why the board, I think, in the final analysis, felt that some kind of public discipline was warranted in this case. The last thing I would mention is that the disciplinary record of this person tends to be somewhat numerous, and one of the things that the board is always concerned about, and I think this court has often expressed concern about, is as complaints increase or become more numerous against a lawyer, it may be time to take some action to protect, preserve the public's interest, protect the integrity of the profession. With that, I think there's not much more I can say. The board believes that it has presented a good case for this court to consider, and I'd be pleased to answer questions if there are some. Thank you.
What about the disagreement that Judge Martin had with respect to the board's findings on this issue, this one issue, about threatening to file Rule 11 sanctions against opposing counsel? How do you deal with that?
Well, I've thought about that, Justice Sinner. It seems to me that for the board itself, that was, I think, part of the whole context of this persistent tendency on the part of this person to always attack personally the people on the other side. As I recall, Judge Martin sort of took a softer view of that because he felt there was some provocation, and he also felt there was some direction, I think, from Mr. Eicher's client concerning whether this claim that he was involved in with the other lawyer might have been fraudulent or otherwise. So I don't know. I think the board genuinely supported its findings. I understand why Judge Martin ruled the way he did. or recommended the way he did. And I just think it's one of those cases where it's kind of in the eye of the beholder, what that does.
Okay, well, what is your view there? Because if a lawyer perceives a case being filed that's frivolous, should that lawyer be prohibited from telling opposing counsel that they're going to file a Rule 11 motion against them?
No.
If they persist in this claim?
No, I don't think the board believes that that ought to be prohibited. No, I don't think so. I think what the board believes is that if you said it, you said it. And you don't need to beat somebody over the head about it. That you don't need to use those kinds of threats to get people to do what you want them to do. And the board took this as a kind of pattern of conduct that showed up here. It showed up in these other, in the case that Cook was involved in. So I think that's part of the difference, Your Honor. That's the best I can explain it. I know that there's a difference of opinion there, but that's the best I can do.
So the board's position is that there should be a public censure of his conduct?
Yes, Justice Sabres, that's correct. I think the gravamen of it all was the trying to bargain out of that complaint with Mr. Cook. You know, when Mr. Eicher received the usual notice from the secretary of the board that a complaint had been filed, here's a copy, here are the rules, you have, what is it, 20 days to make your reply. Immediately, he sent a message to the complainant and said, look, you withdraw your complaint, and I won't appeal this case you and I just got done with. And that is what I think really made this a case for public discipline. Because that appeared to the board, to Judge Martin, and I think if in other courts that have considered the matter to be absolutely contrary to the rules. Violates 8.3, violates 8.4, and the board felt this lawyer needed some kind of public censure to protect the public from that kind of conduct.
I have one other question about the retaliatory complaints. I'm concerned as to whether or not Judge Martin actually did make a de novo finding that the conduct of Attorney E did not warrant Eicher's complaint. Because as it's been briefed to this court, it's been alleged that Judge Trandall ruled in the case itself that Eicher had every right to do what he did in that case. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I thought so, but I'm not sure when you mentioned Judge Trandall.
Well, as I understand it, in the underlying case, Judge Trandall essentially said that Mr. Eicher was okay in doing what he did, or that it was justified. And then I'm wondering whether Judge Martin actually made a finding that that attorney's conduct should not have justified the action that Mr. Eicher took.
I don't know. My guess, if you would take a guess, is that he did not have access to, there was not a way for him to review the other complaints that the board found to be retaliatory. I think that's fair, Your Honor. Yes, I think that's true. I think he accepted the board's finding on that matter.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from the bench? If not, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Banks, will you be reserving time for your client to address the court? We generally encourage it.
Excuse me?
We generally encourage it.
Can I generally follow?
Thank you. You may proceed.
You don't want to go into what circumstances you don't generally follow it, do you?
I'm sorry, sir.
You don't want to go into what circumstances you won't generally follow, do you?
All right. Somehow I knew I was going to be in for this. First of all, Your Honor, I think it's clear to the court, and it's been made clear many times in the briefs, we're not here basically because of this person's fitness to practice law as far as the public is concerned. The public is not in need of protection. We're not here by any claim that Mr. Eicher lied to the court or lied to anyone for that matter. We don't have any complaints by judges about the manner in which Mr. Eicher presents himself in their courts. We have here complaints by lawyers. Now, I realize this might draw some laughter, but the fact of the matter is, we all have varying levels of social graces. We all practice at various levels of adversariness. We do. In this particular case, however, I want to go back to one of the last comments that Mr. Freeberg made. When we start talking about Mr. Eicher trying to negotiate the dismissal of the complaint, is there something wrong, for example, going to a lawyer and saying, no, look, you and I have had our differences. If we can resolve these differences, that's fine. He is not saying that the board can't proceed. Obviously, the board can proceed if it chooses. But I think the board is entitled to know whether or not the personal haranguing is ended. That's all he was trying to achieve. The dismissal would never take place if the board didn't want it to. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to leave time for Mr. Eicher to address some things too, but I want to go into the fact that we're dealing here with complaints against other lawyers that were found by the board to be frivolous and retaliatory. It is not frivolous or retaliatory, it is frivolous and retaliatory. The trial judge adopted the board's findings, and yet the board entered an order that basically the record in these other cases against other lawyers that are supposed to be frivolous and retaliatory was expunged. Was it an effort by Mr. Freeberg? Believe me, he was my classmate in law school. But it seems to me it's very clever in a sense, because we're being precluded then from addressing the facts of those cases because the record is expunged. If this record were to be reviewed, now incidentally, and the comment was made that the trial judge adopted the board's findings that those cases were filed in a manner that was retaliatory and frivolous. Now, he adopted the board's findings. Is that a de novo proceeding? How could he adopt those findings without going into the facts? He had to take what they had to say and their recommendations. There's no other way. As far as the animus of certain persons on the board, it's been suggested, why didn't they raise it? When did it come up? As a matter of fact, it came up right in the middle of the board meeting. Quite surprising. And now keep in mind, Mr. Eicher has not been accused by anyone of lying to anyone. Nor did Mr. Eicher in these proceedings accuse anyone of lying, except in the Koch matter. But in any event, here's where it comes out. And this was from one of the board members. I can identify her if you would like. But here's what she said during the middle of these proceedings. And I guess the thing that's kind of troublesome to the board as a whole, and it's reflected in your correspondence, both on the complaints that were filed against you, but also on the complaints you filed, that you never seem to consider that it may be some merit to the other side's legal position, that there may be some fact your client is either unaware of, etc. I mean, the other side is always wrong, and the other side is always a liar. This is what the board is concerned about. When was that discussed? So when does the personal animus of a board member come out? It comes out right in the middle of the proceedings. What are we supposed to do at that point in time? So if the issue was raised belatedly in front of the hearing examiner, That's the reason. Now,
Mr. Banks, before you go on, you know, you say that there's no lies, or there were no lies, but as you know from your experience, lying is a question of degree sometimes. And how can you say that it's not at least misrepresentation to move to dismiss in that criminal case because the videotape was not available? That was the ground for his motion, that the videotape was not available, yet he had a copy of it. And he used that as a ground to the court to dismiss. If I was the judge in that case, I would have felt very misled.
That's a very good point, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is, if there was a lack of candor at all involved, it was a lack of candor to that judge. That matter was brought to the judge's attention immediately after the opposition raised it as a disciplinary matter. He went right before the judge and it was presented to him, where it is best taken care of. As Judge Konenkamp said in the case, State versus Smith, I believe it is, in his concurring opinion, from my standpoint, a trial judge on the scene supervision is the most effective means for controlling an adversarial excess. In every single case of complaints being made before this body and before the board, in every single case, the matter was attended to by the trial judge either in a rule for 11 sanctions or in their arguments.
Well, but the Constitution is very clear, Mr. Banks, that this court and the disciplinary board and a referee have the disciplinary responsibilities for attorneys, while trial judges have authority on their own for contempt and Rule 11 sanctions. They don't discipline attorneys as far as censure, private reprimand, suspension, or disbarment.
They can on sanctions. They can on terms. The fact of the matter is, and I don't disagree with the court on this, but by the same token, the matter was presented and it was handled. We can't very well say it doesn't matter because we keep talking about what someone else found, what someone else did, and therefore we're finding impetus to our position. For example, argument has been made that the hearing examiner ignored all of this. We're talking about matters that have been reviewed in an appropriate circumstance by some other tribunal or judge.
But just because the matter was handled by the trial judge doesn't mean that Mr. Eicher should have made the representation and statement in the first place, does it? That's what we're here for. Why did he make such a motion when he actually had a copy of the tape? Not whether the trial court fixed it. Sure, the trial court can fix it. The question is his conduct in making the motion when he knew that he had the tape.
You know, Your Honor, I guess what bothered me about that entire incident is the fact that both the prosecutor and the complaining witness, that is Mr. Claiborne, the other attorney, both of them knew that he had a copy of the tape. What wasn't there was the original tape from which the copy was made. He made his motion. This is a criminal case that was being tried. I don't think, for example, when the matter was raised, immediately it was brought to the attention of the judge.
By him, but only because Claiborne said, you know, that's unethical conduct. I mean, Mr. Eicher didn't bring it to the attention of the judge based on his own individual thinking. As a matter of fact, you know, he took a shot at Claiborne at the time he did it. He said, he told the court, I haven't misled the court about anything. The official tapes that are in evidence are not here. He also told the court, but for Claiborne to accuse me of unethical conduct is about how low we've got to this thing. I mean, he can't let it drop without attacking Claiborne. You know, so I don't think his conduct is pristine clear or white.
Your Honor, I don't believe I used the term pristine, clear, or white. I'm not even sure I understand what that means.
Well, maybe I don't either, but I don't think it's very innocent. I don't think it's an aggressive movement on his part against someone who has been critical of him.
I think that that's probably true, Your Honor, in terms of, there are many things that anger us in litigation. For example, when someone is oppressive to a client, for example, is otherwise defenseless, we do have a tendency to let's say, involve ourselves in excesses. We get angry. That's probably what happened here. I'm not going to deny that. But by the same token, as far as the charges that were filed against Mr. Claiborne, you haven't gone back in to look at those. They've been denied from you. But the fact of the matter is, for example, when the charges were made against him as to whether or not they were frivolous, groundless, he demanded that the defendant, before the charges were ever brought, sign a release in violation of the statutes. It's a misdemeanor. Those were brought about and charges filed against Mr. Claiborne, yet they were found to be frivolous and retaliatory. Your Honor, obviously, the adversarial process doesn't make us very gentle sometimes. He was angry. He was angry at what was happening to his client.
Do you...
I'm not going to quarrel with that.
Do you rationalize or justify Mr. Eicher's claims or his attacks on the in the Thomas case on the opponent, on his opponent and the opponent's attorney? He says, paraphrasing, Gail's attempt to avoid any burden at all from her great bounty is shockingly greedy, to put it bluntly. Gail continues to not only want her pound of flesh from Shirley, but wants all of the blood associated with it. Gail's greed is stunningly bold. I mean, it goes on for, you know, four more paragraphs, but Gail's despicable greed should not be rewarded. Let's see. Then to make certain that her fangs are fully bared for all to see, Gail hurls yet another dose of acidic bile at Shirley. Gail accuses Shirley of criminal misconduct. Perhaps Gail plans to have Shirley arrested and hauled from the courtroom on March 27th in shackles, too. Gail's adamant persistence in trying to make Shirley accountable belies an active, rancid animosity against Shirley, which not only defies logic, but apparently knows no bounds. Is this the conduct of a professional lawyer in the state of South Dakota today?
You know, I'll put it this way, Your Honor. I think if you were to know all of the facts and what made Mr. Eicher so angry at these people, you wouldn't have any trouble with what he says about these people. They accuse this poor lady, after a stroke victim, of stealing things, of doing this and of doing that. Sure, it's going to anger and perturb counsel, but representing the other side. I don't have a problem with what was said in those circumstances and in the context of that case.
You think he was reasonably under control, and that's professional conduct should be accepted and approved?
I'm afraid to say yes, Your Honor, for fear that a complaint could be filed against me.
Why is that?
Well, in other words, if I would be endorsing to the letter of what he said, then of course I'm guilty of the same thing before this forum. But I guess to answer your question, it doesn't offend me even a little bit.
Okay.
Knowing the circumstances of that case, he had every right to be angered by what was being done to his client. You know, one of the things that happens to us this day and age is that when you get involved in charges made against your client that compelled you to go forward, and then you have to justify to your client why they should have to pay for proceedings that frankly had no basis in the beginning. This is what we have to go through day after day after day anymore.
You know, counsel, your remedy is to appeal, which has been done in that case, but your remedy is to appeal, not to mouth off in this manner. If you don't like what the judge did or what the judge ruled, your remedy is to take issue with what was done, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, he wasn't objecting to what the court did. It was opposing counsel and his conduct, and it was opposing counsel's client and her conduct. that he was referencing. He wasn't referencing the court's conduct at all.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the matter was presented to the court under the Rule 11 sanctions motions.
Well, let me ask it to you this way. We have a fairly thick file here of complaints. Mm-hmm. Is it your client's position that none of his conduct violates any of the rules of professional conduct?
Your Honor, when you say you have a thick file of complaints, yes, you do. And I guess to answer your question, that is correct. You know, why would I have to admit to a wrongdoing if honestly I didn't believe there was a wrongdoing? That would be hypocrisy.
So you would be satisfied if Mr. Eicher continued to practice law the way he has the past year?
I'm not suggesting, Your Honor, that in the circumstances he wouldn't have to tone down the rhetoric. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm not suggesting it wouldn't be appropriate.
But if I understand your answer to Justice Zinner, you don't think your client's done anything wrong either, as far as violating the professional rules.
In my judgment, Your Honor, that's correct. And you're asking me what my opinion is, because this thing is filled with subjectivity. I don't know what else to tell you other than the fact that, keep in mind, as far as this lawyer is concerned, he's not been complained about by any judge, he's not been complained about by any client, and as far as his fitness to practice law, if that is the test, he measures up. I'll go one step further. I've been asked my opinion on a number of things. He's one of the finest lawyers in the state. And I say that without reservation.
Now, thank you.
Mr. Eicher, would I stand up and say a few words in response?
Mr. Eicher.
I don't know if the court wants to direct questions or just have me talk or how.
Well, I guess initially I would, do you agree with your counsel that you feel you have done nothing improper to violate the rules?
Yes, Your Honor, and this is why. First of all, when we practice law, we learn from the cases that we have, the responses from other attorneys, and the milieu of everything that goes forward, whether in a trial or in pretrial matters or in letter writing or so, and so forth. What I tried to do with the board and with Judge Martin is not to say, look, I'm going to darn well do any of this again. My point was simply this, that here's what I did, and I will tell you honestly and truthfully why I did it. And if I am wrong, you will tell me, and I will abide. Because one thing that people don't have to tell me twice generally about something. But at the same token, as I attached, you know, Mr. Banks and I attached to the objections, I got a letter from one of the board members saying that I had a dysfunction because I faxed a letter to her one evening the night before I flew to New York. My purpose there is to show this is the kind of stuff that happens daily. One of the board members badmouthed me so badly to a member of the bar that member came to me and said, you need to know this. Another board member accosted me in the hallway one time yelling, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you and your whole firm. Justice Sabers may recall in a case called Flockhart versus Wyant, when one of the issues on appeal was whether Mr. Easland was improper in calling me an enabler in a punitive damage case simply because I was the defense lawyer for a woman accused of drunk driving and punitive damages being sought. And I remember Justice Sabers asking Mr. Easland if the court reversed, would the court be an enabler? And the answer was yes. My point is simply that if I've done something wrong, then you will say so, and I will abide. But I'm not going to try to say, well, I really didn't do that. I'm going to fess up to the honesty of my position and why. But I do fear somewhat being the guinea pig where it's not evenly balanced out. If I'm going to be publicly reprimanded for having said about said this or that, and yet I get a letter from a board member saying that I have a dysfunction, that is personally and professionally offensive. Concerning Mr. Cook, the court will recall that the reason that there was a Rule 11 motion against him was because he objected to a deposition saying that, and I would hazard a guess that all the law students here would know the wrongness of his position, he said that an interested party may not be deposed. And then cited a statute that dealt with the court reporter, not the witness. And when I brought that to his attention, he refused to withdraw it. And we had to go before Judge Kern on that point. I had to brief it. My client got charged for the effort. With regard to Gail Thomas in that action, as the court has seen in the appeal issues, my goodness, she's accused of a criminal act because she's a 70-year-old stroke victim with no money who happens to hire an independent contractor who hooks something up wrong, and my client, who didn't even have enough money to pay me to do discovery in the case. That, and in terms of the comments about the greed of the opponent, she was accusing this woman of having stolen a wagon wheel chandelier that her father had, who's sitting right next to her in the courtroom. My client, who cried and sobbed every time she would come to my office, she couldn't understand, she could barely speak. And as she put in the final analysis on the witness stand, she pointed to that other opponent and said, "Awful girl, awful girl, awful girl." Now, do we or do we not have a right to make fair comment? If I went too far in making the fair comment, Judge Kern would have been the best one to know that. In a vacuum, it looks bad. In a vacuum, there was a case, several cases, I believe, that were cited in our brief that showed that in a vacuum, certain comments would be wrong, but not in the individual context. And if I have done something wrong, I am not shirking my responsibility for it. With regard to the contact with Mr. Cook, I want to make sure that the record is clear what happened. It did not happen, as Mr. Freeburg has told this court. What happened is Judge Kern, the day before, had denied the Rule 11 sanctions. Now, I know the court has pointed out to Mr. Banks that there's an ultimate determinator, even above the circuit court, which would be this court. But Judge Kern had just ruled. And the only reason my client was not appealing what little was ruled against her, because the notion that I know it's written up in these books that Mr. Cook's client prevailed, she didn't prevail. Getting an award of $3,000 when you seek $15,000 is prevailing. That's, I guess, in the eye of the beholder. But what I did is I called Mr. Cook and I said, "Diedrich, I'm assuming this is moot because Judge Kern has already ruled." He said, "No." I said, "Well, look, I need to at least forewarn you, Mr." Now, Mr. Cook has not had to testify under oath about any of this, but I'm telling, obviously, you the truth. I said, "Mr. Cook, or Diedrich, I said, I'm just letting you know that the only reason that there hasn't been an appeal is because my client can't afford the transcript. But, and you, Diedrich, can't even tell your own client this because you can't share that information unless I kind of let you. And I'm just telling you, you better talk to your client because there's going to be an appeal if I have to get the transcript." The conversation was not confrontational. It was not angry. And I said to Diedrich, we talked about it, and he understood the conflict. And I said, "You know, we could put some language together to at least let the board know." "Okay." That's what he said. He said, "Okay." I put together something, faxed to him. I said, "Take a look at it," you know, and so forth. There was no demand, "You better do this or else." That's just not true. Moving on for a second to the Courtney Claiborne deal. Here I am in a criminal case representing a single mother who had been fired for allegedly stealing when she didn't steal at all. Mr. Claiborne was named as a witness by the prosecution while he was acting as counsel for the employer in the civil case, and I had contacted him. I said, "Courtney, you have to withdraw. You're a witness." He said, "I'm not a witness. You're a witness." I had to file a motion to have him taken off the civil case because he was a witness. He filed a motion against me saying I was a witness. I wasn't a witness. The night or two or three before the hearing, John Dorsey called me and said, "No, I'm representing the company now. Courtney's off." And I said, "John, am I still an alleged witness?" He said, "No, you're not. Don't worry about it." So when we went to the criminal case, I had written several times to Matt Brown, the prosecutor, and said, Matt, let's watch this videotape together. Let's watch this videotape. No response, no response, no response. Here we are in the midst of trial, and I will happily put novice across this forehead in a criminal case. I handle very few. And he's got Courtney Claiborne on the witness stand, Mr. Brown, and he's questioning him about the videotape. We're going on and on and on, and I'm assuming the next thing is going to be the videotape. We take a break. We go out in the hall, and I said, Matt, when are you going to put the video on? He said, it's lost. I said, what? It's lost. The video's lost. It's lost? He said, it's lost, and it's been lost since July. Now, I found out recently that it wasn't lost. The evidence room has a card. It shows exactly when it was removed, who removed it, and it was Courtney Claiborne's client. Now, did Courtney Claiborne sit? He was on the witness stand. Did he correct when I said to the judge, I've just been told this, and I was talking about the original. Now, did I make a good motion, a smart motion? I don't know. I probably made a dumb motion. I don't have any idea. And I told that to Judge Martin. I said, I don't know if I made a good one. All I'm confronted with is my copies are back at the office. We're talking about the originals. Mr. Claiborne knew I was talking about the originals. Mr. Brown knew I was talking about the originals, or they would have piped up right then. I continued my Judge Severns denied the motion. We continued our cross-examination. We took another break, and I'm standing in the courtroom talking with Matt, and Mr. Claiborne comes off and walks up and goes very angrily, you're unethical. And I turned to Matt, and I said, Matt, you hear this? And he said, leave me out of this. Notice when I argued the motion, Mr. Brown did not say, Your Honor, what's going on here? He's got copies. Because the context wasn't about copies. It was about the originals. Judge Severns certainly wasn't misled, denied my motion. And then when it came to the judgment of acquittal time, he held that Mr. Claiborne's testimony didn't even rise to a prima facie case. Now, Mr. Claiborne was very upset about that because it ended up costing his client in the civil case quite a bit of money. Now, again, I don't know whether I made a good motion. You may be absolutely right that I should have expanded the motion. I have talked with several criminal defense lawyers afterwards to find out if I did good, bad, or indifferent. They all told me they would have done exactly the same thing. I don't know if that means they're right either. And so if I did something wrong, I certainly will believe it, because I'm not a criminal lawyer generally. On this frivolous and retaliatory thing, I had a conversation with Pat Myers on the phone, and then she sent me a letter. And they said I had to file these complaints. And I wrote to them, and I said, look, I don't want to do this. Why should I have to file complaints? Well, because we're not going to listen to it if you don't. And then they punished me for filing complaints. And then, so all I'm saying is that if this is going to be fair, then is the board going to investigate Pat Myers for sending a letter to a home study evaluator saying I have a dysfunction because I faxed her a letter the night before I flew to New York? That's a lot more professionally and personally offensive than this person is a novice who is in need of mentoring because he can't read a statute about whether this applies to a court reporter or not. The last thing I just want to bring up real quickly is Mr. Freeburg said that there's a large number of complaints against me. One of the things that was introduced to Judge Martin was Exhibit A, and that was handed to us right at the hearing. And when I go through this Exhibit A, it's not even accurate. And I just want to make sure the record is clear. It says, for instance, that I filed a complaint against Lawyer A on January 2, 1997. That's true. Lawyer A sent me a two-page dirty limerick that you could write on a bathroom wall. And I wrote to the lawyer and said, I can't believe this. This is terrible. And I sent it to the Bar Association. The Bar Association said there was no violation of professional conduct. Now compare that to whether or not I used overzealous language in the context of a proceeding in a motion to a trial judge several days before the completion of the trial. And they said it's not even a violation. Then they said to both of us, the resolution was, both of you guys just leave each other alone. Okay? Then it says, I filed a complaint against lawyer B on 7/20/01, which the disciplinary board dismissed with a caution. Dismissed with a caution means that they found that the other lawyer had violated. He had sent a investigator to interview my clients when I was representing my clients, and they found that that was improper. So, lawyer says, filed a complaint against lawyer C on May 3, 2002, which the board dismissed with a caution. That's false. A client hired me, a client from Romania who speaks very little English, hired me to file a complaint on her behalf against her former attorney. That was my entire role in the case, and I let the board know. That ended with a public censure, and it wasn't my complaint, it was for a client. And then it goes on about all these, on May 15, I filed complaints against these lawyers. Well, that's the ones that I filed here, because when I said I don't want to, I shouldn't have to. And then during the testimony before the board, half the room was, one of the board members was putting the statute book in front of me saying that I had a duty to file these complaints and I could be punished if I don't. Then I get punished for filing them. Then it goes on about disciplinary records against me. It says I've been the subject of 7 complaints, first of which in 1992 the board dismissed. Yeah, the board dismissed it and said that I had done nothing wrong. Nothing wrong, period. Second, in 1997, the board dismissed with a caution. That was when the opposing lawyer who wrote the limerick complained that I got on his rump about it, which I think was fair. The third complaint, 98, was dismissed and expunged. A client thought that I had not given her all the money back from her trust account and sent it to the board, and the board said, oh yeah, you clearly did. The fourth complaint, 2001, Mr. Eicher received an admonition. That's the one that Judge Trandall ruled that I had done nothing wrong. In fact, the order specifically states Mr. Eicher had every right to do what he did. But guess who the complainant was? Board member Greg Easland. Well, he's not going to sit and rest on that laurel that he just got, that Judge Trandall completely disagreed with him.
My understanding is Mr. Easland did not sit on your case.
Mr. Easland sat on my case for a while. Mr. Easland participated in the April meeting. For instance, and I can certainly close with this. The assertion that this is always happening, I can look every one of you in the eye and tell you that this isn't always happening. This is not always happening at all. I could bring a phalanx of lawyers who I get along with extremely well, and judges who will say the same. I've had judges appoint me to do certain things for them.
You could have submitted that evidence in the before either the referee or the board, couldn't you?
That's not quite true, because before the board, because of the rules against disclosure and the rules about privilege, you can't even tell your own client. For instance, in this situation, I asked permission of the board to bring two of my clients to testify for me. They did not grant it. When you go before the board, they tell you who your witnesses are or not. You cannot question any witness. And I asked them. I asked them also if they would allow me to present them with the transcript of the Cook case, or that Thomas case. Nope. It's just, you know, all I'm saying is that when a lawyer tells you that you're wrong, or a board tells you you're wrong for doing certain things, and then they turn right around, in this case here with Ms. Myers writing that letter which I attached for you, what's going to happen to her? Is she going to stand before the five of you and have to say why she wrote a letter to a home study evaluator saying that I had a dysfunction? Is that civility? She sits on the board when her firm is representing the complainant? I don't think that's very fair. But I know you'll do the right thing, whatever that right thing is, and I will adhere to it. You will not ever find me here again on this kind of thing. I can assure you. But my point is not that bad damn good me. My point is this is what I did, why I did it, and if it's wrong, all I ask is that it be evenly applied. That's all I ask.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Freeburg, your response?
I do believe it's necessary for me to at least have some rejoinder to what we've just heard. First of all, the rules of the disciplinary board clearly provide that persons who are responding to complaints can produce witnesses, they can cross-examine witnesses, they can present evidence, and I'm startled that Mr. Eichhardt would represent to you that the board denied him any of those rights.
Were you at that hearing?
Yes.
Are you representing to us as an officer of the court that that was never brought up? Is it in the transcript?
I tried to find that now, but I didn't have time to dig it out of the transcript before he finished his remarks. But I know that in the notice that goes out, those rules of procedure are included in the notice. They're published in the South Dakota Code. And it's the practice at each hearing before the board for each person to advise them of what their rights are. So I have not refreshed my memory, but that is the procedure.
They are allowed to tell their clients that there's been a disciplinary action filed against them and call them as a witness. I think that was his.
The rule of confidentiality is to protect the respondent, Your Honor. And the respondent certainly has to be able to present a defense. The respondent can run at the newspaper. It's those of us who are not respondents. It's to protect the confidentiality of the person about whom complaint has been made. So I just think that's a startling position to take. Secondly, certainly this a lawyer whom has been represented to you as one of the best lawyers in South Dakota ought to be able to figure that out. It's in the books. It's in the reported cases. Obviously, any lawyer accused of misconduct is entitled to due process, which would be the right to produce witnesses and to cross-examine. He had those rights twice, and now shows up here this morning to suggest that they were somehow denied to him by the board is frankly preposterous. The second rejoinder that I would have is that if you look at the correspondence from board member Pat Myers, which is in the exhibits, I think it's a letter of, I want to say May 22nd, but I'm not sure about the date. What the letter says is if you have complaints about the conduct of other lawyers, that is not a defense to what you have may have done. If other lawyers have engaged in misconduct, then you are obliged under rules to report that. That's a far cry from saying, Mr. Eichhardt, you have to report those lawyers. Think about the statements that you've heard here today that the public's not in need of protection. Judges haven't complained. Why should I be held accountable then for this conduct? That's why we're here today, because this respondent doesn't understand that lawyers have a particular obligation to society and to the profession to protect its integrity. That's the oath we take. That's the responsibility we assume. And it's not a game. And that is not an adversarial process. That's what we're here to do. And whether Judge Severance complained about withholding information about the tape, whether Judge Trandall ruled one way or whether Judge Kern ruled another way is beside the point. That was not their obligation. But it's the obligation of the disciplinary board as your representative to bring these matters to you. And the board felt in this case the public needs to be protected from this kind of conduct because it's detrimental to the administration of justice and to the integrity of our profession.
Thank you, Mr. Freeberg. This is the final argument of the March term here at the South Dakota School of Law. We would like to, as a court, thank Dean Vickery for once again being a most gracious host. Thank his administration, the faculty, the students, especially those of you who served as monitors. We would like to thank the South Dakota Highway Patrol for providing security. With that, we are in recess.